I'd like to welcome everybody to Spotlight. And in Spotlight, we interview different ones of our members. And Steve Shepherd's the interviewer today. So we'll turn the program over to Steve, and he can introduce our guest today. Go ahead, Steve.
Well, hello, everyone, and thanks for coming to Spotlight, where we put the spotlight on the life of one of our members before the people. Today we are very privileged and excited to have Walt from Canada with us. And Walt, hello and good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon, Steve, and good afternoon, everybody. Just a bit of information. Today it's cold. The temperature is minus 12 Celsius, which is around 11 above Fahrenheit, and which is a little warmer than it has been for the last few days. So we're into spring mode, even if it is in December.
Good gracious. This is December 7th, 2002, a cold day in Canada. And what part of Canada are you in, Walt?
I'm located in southwestern Manitoba, the town of Brandon, which is the second largest city in the province of Manitoba. And this is a large city, about 45,000. In most places in the U.S., that's a medium-sized town.
So how long have you lived in Manitoba?
Well, I lived in Manitoba since 1981. I moved to a place about 100 miles northwest of Brandon, up in the Riding Mountain National Park area. Lived there for about 3 years and then moved into Brandon in 1984, the year Big Brother was watching.
Okay, very good. Well, let's go back a little further. Walt, where are you from? When were you born, unless you don't want to give that secret away?
Okay, I'm getting a bit of a chop on you there, Steve. I think you asked where I was from. I was born and raised in New Jersey. Lived in Union County and Middlesex County in New Jersey, although I spent a lot of time all over the state. Did my undergraduate work in university in New Jersey and then came up to Waterloo, Ontario to do my master's in theology at Wilfrid Laurier, or Waterloo Lutheran Seminary, as it used to be called. Wilfrid Laurier is the name of a former Prime Minister of Canada. And, of course, they renamed the college to maintain the WLU thing. So that's how I got here and what I got for some kind of credentials. There's a few more, but we won't go into that. That's a long story.
Well, we have some time. But I would like to go a little bit more into your growing up years, your early schooling. Were you blind then? Are you totally blind? What is your visual condition, or whatever you want to share with us there?
Yeah, I was born blind, totally. No vision whatsoever, not even light perception. And grew up in the public school system, well, the fully integrated school system, actually, in New Jersey. My parents were real pioneers and really fought for that, which was quite something. In those days, born in 44, so in 1949 I entered the school system, so I'm an old guy. And did all my public school work in New Jersey and my university at Uppsala College in East Orange, New Jersey, Steve.
Okay, well, you went to school in 1949 to public school. That's kind of unusual, I think, for that time. Many blind people were sort of put away, sent away to school. Tell us about that. How was public school in early 50s, and what were your parents like to support you and want to mainstream you?
Public school was okay. I didn't mind it at all. I was in with the regular kids. We had a sight-saving braille class every morning from 9 o'clock until 11 o'clock. And then we're back out in the regular school stream. That lasted through grade 6. And my parents were extremely supportive and extremely encouraging in every way they could be. They were both very, very open-minded and accepting people, and it wasn't too hard to do things without their help and guidance.
They say we had a class, a braille class. Were you the only blind person in the school, or were there more?
No, there were more. There were definitely more, about 20 of us. My brother was also there. He was also born totally blind. He became an electrical engineer and worked in missile guidance systems for many, many years at a plant in New Jersey. And he never came to Canada. He stayed there. And, of course, Jim passed away many years ago at the age of 45, and I outgrew him in more ways than one.
Ah, you were his younger brother, right?
That's correct. I mean, I was 42 when he died at 45, and I've lived 13 years longer than he did so far.
Okay, quick math says you're 58. Very good. Congratulations for making it to 58, and I hope I do. What were your interests in school, Walt? You seem to be educated in theology. Was that always a major interest?
Yes, it was, although in university I double majored. I majored in languages and religion, historical religion. I got to study all the world religions, and I majored in Spanish, French, and Greek. And I remember I had all three language exams on one day, and I did the Greek exam in perfect Spanish and handed it in, and the Greek professor couldn't read it, so I had to translate it from Spanish into English for him, and we had quite a laugh over that.
My gracious, now that was undergraduate. That's quite a load for undergraduate work. And the history of religions, was your interest more academic than philosophical, or a calling of God, or explain a little bit about that?
My interest was both. It was right down the middle. I really felt called to ministry, and I really felt that I needed to study more about the other faiths, because one of my main issues in life has always been tolerance. And tolerance, patience, and kindness are three of my bywords that I really, really stress in my own life, and I work hard at those, and that historical emphasis on the other religions did help me to see ways that I could be become more tolerant and patient and kind, and I hope I live up to that particular motto.
Well, very good. Now, that was the undergraduate, and what did you do from there, Walt?
In 1967, I applied to many seminaries, seminary in Minneapolis, Mount Airy in Philadelphia, a couple of other ones, Gettysburg, I can't remember exactly all of them, and the only one that accepted me was Waterloo Lutheran, or Wilfrid Laurier, in Waterloo, Ontario, Canada, southern Ontario. So I came to Canada with the idea of doing my postgraduate work, which I did. I graduated seminary in 1971, and then the fun started. I didn't become a minister right away. In fact, entered into a lot of bickering and fights with liturgical churches, because they had a really difficult time accepting a visually impaired or visually repaired person like myself who never had any vision, and it was an uphill battle, and it was a battle from there.
Visually repaired, I've never heard that term, Walt. Why do you use that term?
And that goes back to a little private joke. Friends of mine asked me, what would you do if you could see? And due to the nature of my blindness, which is optic atrophy, which is a mute recessive genetic gene, I said, well, I'd have to have a head transplant if I needed to see. I'd have to be visually repaired. And the rest of the head seems to work okay, so I'll stay in the darkness for a little while longer and enjoy it.
I like that, visually repaired. Interesting. Well, you certainly overcame your visual limitation in what you've done so far in your life. You haven't let anything stop you, have you?
No. Actually, I've done a lot of traveling and a lot of hobbies. Been amateur radio for 43 and a half years. Repair computers and do all sorts of things. And usually, if something breaks around here, I'll give it a shot and see if I can fix it.
Well, this may sound like a... What did you try that you just didn't feel competent in that maybe changed a direction or defined a direction in your life?
Well, there are actually a number of things. I think for me, what's helped me to become what one might call successful is the fact that failures have played a great part in my life, but it's how what you do with the failures that is important. When a person fails at something, you know, you get up off the canvas and you try again, but you learn from what you did. You learn from your mistakes, and there are many mistakes. I mean, I had a first marriage that went on the rocks due to alcoholism. It wasn't my problem, but it was. I was affected by it, and a great many things happened as a result, and because of that, I learned a lot of things about myself that I could take into the second marriage. And I remember failing a sociology course in university, and I still maintain that even though I finally passed it by the skin of my teeth, it was one of the courses I learned the most from about myself and about my learning abilities because I did fail it. So I've always been philosophical about failing. Where do I go from here? What did I learn from it? Is the mistake, can I make the mistake profitable, or can I allow the mistake to destroy me? And my choice has always been to try to make it meaningful for myself and for others around me if I can.
Beautifully said, beautifully said. Okay. I know that you have done substance abuse counseling, and I want to get into that. You've given us a taste of maybe what started you on that road. Is that what got you interested? The fact that you were married to an alcoholic and had to learn about the disease from the standpoint of being a family member, is that what got you interested in substance abuse?
Yes, very definitely. It was born out of the failure of the first marriage, my interest. Also, there's another thing that got me interested. When I was serving in a congregation in Northern Ontario, there were many, many alcoholics that I ran into, because that's all there is to do in this particular place I was at, was drink, eat, sleep, and work. And a lot of them, alcoholics, found I was a soft touch. You know, if you wanted money, if you wanted food, you come to me, you'll get it. And what I had to learn was to be a sensible touch, not a soft one, so that you could know when to employ love and how tough the love needed to be, kind of thing. But I did 3 weeks training in 1978 at a treatment center in Thunder Bay, Ontario, and I fell in love with the recovery program. I really felt the recovery program was very, very miraculous in many, many ways. And ever since that particular time, I've been a Socialist Anonymous and Al-Anon. Since I'm not an alcoholic myself, I've been associated with Al-Anon, which is for spouses and friends of alcoholics. And I went into the addictions field as a direct result of that. And it's a very, very, it was a very, very stressful job, but extremely rewarding when you see people that discover the miracle of how a higher power can transform their lives.
Yeah, it must be very rewarding to have spent a long time, a lot of time with people with no hope and a problem that was much larger than themselves, and then to show them that there's a way out. A way to turn life around. It must be very rewarding. Now that you took that first 3 week course, you were still in seminary school, were you not?
No, that was part of a continuing education requirement the church had. Every so many years you had to take continuing education to keep yourself current, much like doctors do, and much like other people in the professional fields have to do. Professional development, that's what we call it up here. And I took the treatment as a direct result of professional development training, and I loved it, and I still love it to this day. I just really, really think that the recovery process is one of the greatest miracles that we can see evidence of this very day.
Okay, we're having a little bit of breakup, Walt, but I'm getting most of what you say, and I'm very fascinated. I'm seeing a sort of a gravitation, a pull towards a field, which obviously is substance abuse. It started with an interest in theology, and you were educated in the social sciences, such as sociology, and about the mind and about culture and how people behave. And all that kind of led you to the field that you devoted yourself to. So I assume that you've always been connected to substance abuse through the church, through your role as a minister. Is that right?
Yes, it is, directly and indirectly. It is very, very correct. I've seen it in the congregation, and I've seen what it can do to people and families and all that, and really wanted to do something that would make a difference and hope that I could make a difference. And I've been very, very thankful to my God, as I understand God, that I've had the opportunity to do that, you know, without becoming some kind of a fool about it or whatever. Just go about your work and watch people recover and watch them embrace the way back to life. It's just a great, great experience of which I was privileged to be a part.
And, well, you are an ordained minister in what church?
I work for the United Church of Canada, which is a combination of the Presbyterian Church in Canada, the Methodist Church in Canada, and the Congregational Church in Canada. The three of them amalgamated on June 8th, 1925, way before I was born. And I became a United Church pastor. Even though I was trained in a Lutheran seminary, I became involved with the United Church and really liked its sense of social consciousness and its sense of conscience and its sense of direction, that it really tried to deal with issues for the poor, the downtrodden, whatever you want to say, the underdog, the disabled. I really liked its policies and gravitated there.
Very good. Very interesting. That's a church I'm not familiar with. Of course, I'm not from Canada, so I wouldn't be. Is that a large church in Canada?
Yes, it's very large, actually. The membership is over 8 million at present. It's around 10 million, actually, which is fairly large for one single denomination in Canada, and it's very, very, very big, and, you know, That part I don't like about largeness. I like the small, intimate groups, and I work better in small, intimate groups than great big ones, and really, really enjoy that kind of thing. But nevertheless, it allows you to search and find your own answers to your own questions, and yet bring them to a common ground, which is, you know, the love that unites us all, the love in Christ.
All right. Well, thanks for explaining more about that to us. I'm just not as familiar with Canada. Now, you retired. You said you're three quarters retired. You retired when?
I retired on June the 30th, 2000. And retired from the addictions field. I still preach. I do part-time computer work. I also do a lot of consulting in the field of addictions, with grief counseling and counseling regarding spirituality. I maintain a tri-weekly lecture on spirituality at the local treatment center, and I do a lot of work with people to help them try to find out where and who their God is, the God of their understanding that can work in their life. And sharing one little incident, there was a fellow who came to me about 2.5 years ago in my office and said, you know, I'm trying to find God. And I said, well, remember, God isn't lost.
Okay, well put. I find myself wanting to hear you talk more because you sound like such a good speaker and so much to say. Boy, there might be other times on for the people that there are contributions you can make.
Well, I would appreciate that, and I think it'll happen. It's just a matter of getting the free time to do it. I keep myself fairly busy. And, of course, my good wife and I, we do a little musicking together. She plays the harp and plays keyboard and sings like an angel. So we have a lot of fun musically, and we're doing a lot of that, especially over the Christmas season. We had work together on Thursday at a dinner a little bit, and we're going to be doing the same thing on Sunday and a bunch of other little times, even on Christmas Day. And Brandon has a large dinner for the lonely, the poor, the sad. It's great, and we're going up there just to be with them and share with them and just to be a part of life in general. And whoever comes to that dinner, you know, we embrace and share whatever we have with them. It's great.
Oh, gracious. That sounds very good. What, while your wife plays all these instruments and sings, you said you do music together. What do you do?
I'm a blues guitarist and a bluegrass banjo picker, although mostly the blues guitarist. I love the blues.
Oh, boy, you are talking to the right person there as far as liking it. I love it. I'd love to hear you, too, sometime. Well, that's great. Do you mostly do your music in church-related functions as well as the addiction field?
Yeah, I do, my wife and I do a lot of Celtic things together. That's another second love of mine is Celtic music, but I do the blues. My wife doesn't sing the blues much, and a harp doesn't lend itself much to the blues. But we get together and have a lot of fun. We entertain for, you know, senior citizens and for groups and have a lot of fun, actually. Sometimes we just get out our tape recorders and entertain to get a sound file and have some
fun. Okay. Well, there's a whole other area of your life that we have not touched on, Walt, and that is, I know that you've done a lot of traveling, and I'd like you to talk a little more about that. You've been many places. Now, has most of it been since you retired, or was some of it before then? Where have you been, and what do you do?
I've been to Mexico, Puerto Rico, Honduras, and Cuba before I retired. Had a wonderful, wonderful stay in Cuba. I went there on a church mission. My wife went, who does not speak Spanish, and I. And cute, too. Over 4,000 kilometers, which is probably in the neighborhood of over 2,000 miles around the island. I've visited with various schools for the blind, hospitals, many, many education things. And that was one of our trips. The last one we went on was to Ireland. We were there for 7 weeks. Just loved it. Traveled all over the Republic of Ireland, which is southern part of Ireland. And just had a great time. We were in the pubs and, you know, getting to meet the people. Didn't take many of the tours, but it was a wonderful, wonderful trip. Except coming back, we got stuck in Amsterdam on 9/11. We got stuck in Holland, and I knew I was there too long when I was starting to understand Dutch after the fourth and fifth day, and we lost all our luggage and lost the razors and the socks and the underwear, so every night we had to be in sync. We had to wash our stuff in the sink to keep ourselves happy and kind of, shall we say, hygienically prepared for the next day. We were very, very happy to see Canadian soil again and see home. I was wondering when we'd get there, but we did. And that was certainly a very wonderful yet frightening experience on 911.
Yes, I would think that would be frightening. What exactly did you hear in Amsterdam? What did you know as unfolded? Of course, the whole world was affected that day, and it's interesting to hear people's stories about that.
Well, actually, we had just arrived from Dublin. We went Dublin to Amsterdam, Amsterdam to Minneapolis, Minneapolis to Winnipeg. We had just arrived in Amsterdam and gotten our luggage cleared security and everything. We were just on the way down the jetway to the plane when some people came running out and said, we can't go, there's been an accident, and all the airports in the United States are closed. So our first knowledge of it was an accident. And then I got my little shortwave radio out and tuned into the BBC in the airport and found out that the World Trade Towers had been struck by the planes. And everybody was shocked. I mean, that night there were between 10 and 15,000 people in one airport. You have to understand, though, that Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam is very large. It's a very, very big airport. I think it's the fourth or fifth largest in the world. And it was just crowded with people. And the first night we spent in the airport, and then the nightmare unfolded. But it also was a way in which we met a lot of people and got to understand a lot of things. But it was very, very interesting time.
Yeah. I didn't really realize that that air travel all over the world was really affected, I suppose. Not everywhere, but anywhere coming into the United States, of course, was. And, so that's a different perspective. Well, thank you. And you mentioned Cuba. That's fascinating. You were there with a church group, and you visited blind groups in Cuba?
Yes, we did. Every province has a school for the blind, and the schools for the blind are a little different than ours because they actually have resident psychologists on staff and a few other things like that, which we were quite impressed, actually, with the way in which the schools were run. And, of course, we heard some songs about Che Guevara and some of the, Viva la Revolución songs and things along those lines, but most of all, we met the children and the teachers and had a great interchange, as people without sight have so much in common. There's that kind of instant bond when you don't have sight. By the way, my wife doesn't have that much sight either. She has more than I do, but anybody does. If you have sight, it's more than I have. But getting back to the Cuban situation, it was wonderful because we met the people. We went to visit AA there, addictions. Visited some addiction centers, some hospitals, some schools for the blind, and some churches. And the joy we found in their poverty was absolutely and has been absolutely unparalleled in my short history on this planet. The joy was wonderful. And I will never, ever forget the marvelous and sincere and glorious embraces that we shared in many, many times in Cuba. People who had nothing to give you and yet gave you everything. And I just, praise God for the encounter that my wife and I had with those folks.
Oh, Walt, I didn't know they had AA in Cuba. Being a spiritually oriented type of program.
Yeah, it's very strong. It's very strong there. And everybody's in it. I mean, professionals, whatever, because alcoholism is very prevalent, and there are no treatment facilities as such in Cuba yet. There is one that they're working on around Santiago de Cuba, which is in the eastern end of Cuba. And I always say that AA always shakes up people's lives in many ways, so they would have to put the treatment center in the place on the island where the most earthquakes were, so obviously there's going to be a lot of shook up people in recovery.
It does tend to shake things up, doesn't it? Honduras, Mexico, where else have you been?
I've been to San Juan and Santurce in Puerto Rico and loved it. except the cab drivers, they always took us the long way so they could get more money, but I wasn't too impressed with that.
Okay. And you still travel, Walt, unofficially or non-professionally, do you not?
Yes. Actually, my wife and I are involved fairly heavily in RVing. We really enjoy the RV. We have a trailer, and we have a friend who is gracious enough to pull us around almost everywhere he goes, and we have a lot of fun camping and making fires and terrorizing the countryside and having just a great deal of fun. That's our favorite summer recreation.
Do you stay mostly in Canada for this camping activity, or do you come down to the U.S.? I'd love for you to come visit Hallie and me.
Well, sometime that might happen. You never know. We don't go to the U.S. too much, except into North Dakota, which is fairly close by. We go to a local park that's not very far from here and some lakes that are fairly close by within maybe an hour's drive or an hour and a half drive. And we try to camp by the water if we can. We love the birds and the sunsets and the general experience. I do find that the wonderful creature called the mosquito, which was also created out of love like we were, the mosquito is more prevalent by the lake shores, but then again, that's the way it goes. It's one of the fringe annoyances of camping.
Well, Barry, Walt, I just think that mosquitoes are kind of a mistake, one of God's mistakes. Maybe he didn't make mistakes, but why is there a mosquito? Tell me that.
It's God's sting operation.
I got you. All right. Well, you've had a very fortunate and interesting life, and I'm sure there's lots of questions, and I'd love to open the floor for questions for Walt from Canada. Walt, what's your last name, if you don't mind sharing that?
My last name is Gibbons, G-I-B-B-O-N-S. A good Irish name, and there isn't an ounce of Irish in me.
Okay. Well, are there any questions for Walt Gibbons from Canada, from the floor?
Yes, I have one, Walt. As a council assessor, assessing the bees outside of alcohol, what was the most common substance?
There were two of them. One was marijuana, and the other was crack cocaine. And I say that very surprising, because both of them are at different ends of the drug spectrum.
The reason I asked the question was because you hear in the press that drugs are on their way down, and you work with it every day, almost every day, and of course, the reasons why poverty and what have you, but I was just kind of curious.
Okay, I missed some of your last statement. There was a bit of break up there, Bob, but there's such a difference between I think the worst people to work with are those who are on prescription drugs, because a lot of them end up on the prescription drugs because they have to be, and then become addicted to painkillers and become addicted to certain medications. The old antidepressants used to be extremely addictive, the Luds, Quaalude and Cinnalude and things like that, but the new ones, of course, aren't, and you get people that were strung out on tranquilizers and all sorts of things, and those were definitely the worst ones to get people away from because of their long, long half-lives and long withdrawals.
Hi there, this is Country Music Mar, or Country Caroler. First of all, I wanted to mention Steve, you did a great job on the interview. It was great being able to hear you. But Walt, I wanted to ask you, is there a different procedure for weaning people off of different types of substances?
Yes, there is. There are a number of different procedures which range from total abstinence to what we call harm reduction, choosing the least harmful alternative. And all the procedures work. The difficulty is determining which one will work the best, and usually you have to go with where the client's at and what the client thinks and how they feel to help you determine which process is used. With the harder substances like cocaine and pills, it's got to be harm reduction all the way. For example, if you're using a substance like any of the azepams or Librium or any of those things, you want to use a step-down process whereby you gradually bring the person off the substance, because the withdrawal is so intense that the person wants to go back on it because they want to escape the withdrawal symptoms. So there are very many different processes, and that's one of the things that can be very, very hard to make a judgment on, especially if you get a person who is multi-addicted. Wow.
Hi there, Walt. I missed the original interview, so pardon me if I ask a question that maybe somebody else has already asked. Here in the United States, in Southern California especially, and I'm sure other parts of the country, we have people that are on drugs, various different kinds of drugs, anything from, marijuana to, we got crack, we got crank, we got cocaine, we got all sorts of stuff. But we also have a gang population which encourages and coerces people to get on these kinds of things. Is there a difference in the mentality of the Canadians versus the United States to treat these people? Because here in the United States, the people that go to prison for selling drugs and doing a lot of other things, oftentimes in Southern California especially, and California in general, are they're put up on a pedestal. Good for you. You went to jail. Do you see that up there in Canada?
Yes, we do. We see that. I think, though, one of the things that I'm kind of excited about up here in Canada is we're tending to treat addictions in general as a health problem rather than a law problem or a legal problem. And when you treat it as a health problem, you tend to deal with things a little bit more positively. You give the person what they need to know and what they need to do to help them get off a thing, rather than say, okay, man, you're a bad boy from the start. And I believe the bad boy from the start mentality sets up the criminality mentality. In other words, the criminal mentality sets up the recidivistic jail thing. In other words, if you're criminals have a way of being proud of it sometimes, and that whole thing sets it up. Whereas if we begin to take the health problem approach, it's much more sensible and much more sane. And people begin to really discover that addiction is an illness and it's a lifelong battle, and they need help to do it, and they get plugged into the support groups a lot easier, and are not as proud of their failures, but are willing to learn from them. And that's the key. It's been the key in my life, is to learn from the failures. I had a heart attack 8 years ago, and came pretty close with death, and I really think that has been one of the most positive learning experiences in all my life, because when I wake up each day, that life is there, and I appreciate that life. I am so glad to have the opportunity to live a single day more.
So you discover then that it's actually easier for them to alter their behavior when it's treated as a health problem.
Absolutely. And the other thing that makes it easier is you respect their expertise. I mean, they have the problem. They know more about how they feel than I do. And when we respect that expertise and give them a say in their treatment, it's amazing how the person responds.
I have to agree with that. I remember I worked in the medical industry for 25 years, and I remember a story that one of the emergency room people told me about. A guy came in, and he had been on intravenous drugs, which means he stuck it in his arm or somewhere on his body for a long, long time. And he came in, and he had great problems. He wanted to get better. He wanted to work with everybody, but they couldn't start an IV. And he took the needle out of the doctor's hand and said, "Hey, let me do this." He knew just what to do. So I agree with that entirely. If they're willing to work with you, then you should work with them.
Well, very definitely. And most people are. I mean, most people want to get better and want to get to feeling better about themselves and stuff like that. And if you work with the person, you find that basically my philosophy is to help them, A, tap their own resources, and B, discover that a power greater than themselves can restore to sanity, can cure help with unmanageability, can help with just everyday problems. And if those two things happen, wow, you're on a pretty exciting road.
But I know too, Walt, that you say that most people want to get better. You have to want to get better more than you want to continue the behavior. And sometimes that takes a long time and a lot of tries. Is it ever frustrating to you? Do you ever throw your hands up and say, "I'm not doing the good I want to do"?
There's no question. There's no question that it is. There are a lot of people, who don't make it, and I don't want to paint a rosy picture. Even in today's world of addiction, 1 in 37 people see the inside of a treatment facility that can help them recover. What happens to the other 36 that we don't see? I do know one thing. They end up on my prayer list every night, even if I don't know their names. Because, it's suffering at its worst. In many cases, addicts and alcoholics and people like that know more about remorse and shame and guilt than any of us will ever know.
Okay. I'd like to make one more final comment, but, working in a field like I did, and I worked in a training facility, a major medical center. We dealt with all sorts of trauma and so forth, but the basic thing that I talk about with the psychologists and so forth that brought the people through the department I worked for is this. They have to hit rock bottom and feel like the only way left is up. And some people can't do that. So hats off to you all. Keep doing what you're doing, because you can save some people, but you can't save them all.
Yeah, well, when you came over to Ireland, I'm not even in Ireland, but did you meet blind people in Ireland itself then?
Yeah, we sure did. We spent one whole day in the Irish Society for the Blind in Dublin. We had some wonderful times, and we did meet some blind folks, and it was, very, very rewarding for the most part. Just one comment about people hitting their bottom. I also believe that people can be led to their bottom as well, to be led to realize where they're at. It's up to them, of course, to drink the water. But, you know, even if we plant the seed, that's as important as the tree itself.
I agree.
Okay, and the other question for Walt.
Just wanted to take with the interview, Walter, and I knew I would. You're always fascinating. Thanks.
Well, it's my pleasure. Absolutely my pleasure. And, you know, if ever I can be of some small assistance in some small way, and it goes for you guys, too, like, we're here to help each other, and that's what it's all about. It's not, you know, the helper helping the helpless, but the helpless helps the helper as much. In fact, many is the chance when I've gotten to say to my clients and people I know, you know, I've learned more from you than you'll ever know. And that's what it's all about. I mean, it's a mutual enhancement. I know my spiritual philosophy is that everybody I meet has something with which to enhance my life, and my job is to find it. And in doing so, my prayer is that somehow I might enhance and enrich theirs. Thank you very much.
Yeah, well, I'd like to thank you for coming on today on Spotlight, and it was very interesting, and really enjoyed it. And I'd also like to thank Steve for doing the interview. You did a nice job, Steve. And also thank you, Dennis, for doing the recording. And I'm glad everybody showed up, and it was wonderful.
Yeah, thanks so much, Walt, for a very enlightening, interesting interview. Next week we'll have another Spotlight. Please come back. And I guess we'll call it to a close for now. Thank you, everyone.